Coming up on this week's book show, and Richard Russo's latest, Chances Are, a reunion on Martha's Vineyard reopens old mysteries and wounds for three Vietnam-era college friends. Russo is the author of 8 novels, most recently Everybody's Fool and That Old Cape Magic. In 2002, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls. Richard Russo on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, and recorded before a live audience at the Zankel Music Center on the campus of Skidmore College. In Richard Russo's new novel, Chances Are, three 66-year-old men convene on Martha's Vineyard one beautiful September day. Friends ever since meeting in college circa the 60s, they couldn't have been more different then or even today. As this new weekend unfolds, three lives and that of a significant other are displayed in their entirety, while the distant past confounds the present with surprise and discovery. Richard Russo is the author of 8 novels, most recently Everybody's Fool and That Old Cape Magic, 2 collections of stories in the memoir Elsewhere. In 2002, he received the Pulitzer Prize for Empire Falls. Again, the latest is Chances Are, and it's a pleasure to welcome Richard Russo to this week's book show. Welcome back. Nice to have you here.
It is always so great to be here.
I am thrilled to talk to you about this novel because it's a fun novel because it was a surprise to me in reading it. I have in my mind what I think a Richard Russo book will be, and this one has suspense in it. This one has a little mystery, a little twist to it, and I thought,
an actual plot.
Well...
You wouldn't go that far?
I see. I haven't found that missing in your previous work, but I will say that I thought it was fascinating that this element it's a page turner.
Well, thank you. I felt as I was writing it the same sense of surprise that you felt in reading it.
Did you know going into it that okay, there was going to be an element of this that is going to have to unfold in a way that is going to hold us by the lapels a little bit?
Yeah, the slow release of information is the kind of thing that you'd typically get with a thriller or a mystery. I didn't know that. I didn't set out to write a mystery. I didn't set out to write a thriller. But I did know from the beginning that this was going to be a book about secrets and lies. That being true, obviously you cannot tell the reader early on what the characters themselves don't know. And the secrets that they are concealing from each other, and so you just hold this information back until it's the right time to release it. That's a very different sort of mechanism. I was joking earlier about this book having an actual plot, but a lot of my earlier books, if you look at them, didn't. You could always, I gave them titles, but the titles could have been The Adventures of Donald Sullivan. Or The Adventures Of, because they were kind of loosey-goosey sorts of things. You'd hopefully found a character that you were enjoying being around, and then you would just follow them on their travels. And I was trusting to the fact that at the end of that they would go somewhere, and at the end of it we would know what the journey was about. This is very different. The authorial reins are being held a little tighter, and I had to know a little bit more in writing this book at the outset than I typically did with my other books.
So what did you have to know?
In a typical mystery, for instance, A fairly simple question is always asked. Who killed Roger Ackroyd? You don't know at the beginning. You do know at the end when Poirot explains the whole thing to you.
Right.
In this book, one of the reasons that it reads like a thriller or a mystery and not like all of my other novels is that it does pose that basic kind of plot question. Those of you who haven't read it, this is not a spoiler. You will learn, this is something you learn in the first chapter, is that the three main characters in this book, all 66 years old when the book opens, they are all haunted by memories of the same girl that they were in love with back when they were 21. Her name was Jacy, and the basic plot question that gets posed at the beginning of this book is what happened to her, because she disappeared. So then what do I have to know? Well, first I have to know that she's disappeared and,
right.
and that these guys are going to be haunted by her. But eventually I have to know what happened to her. And it took me about 100-150 pages to figure that out. I didn't know at the beginning.
And once you get into that 150 pages and you say, okay, this is what's going to happen to Jacy.
Right.
Do you then have to go back in the revision to solidify that in the process?
Yeah. Because until you figure that out, you don't know what you've done in those first 150 pages that will contradict that thing that you now know. So you have to go back. Mysteries, thrillers, in some ways have to get written back to front. It's a lesson that I learned and forgot because Robert Benton and I made a movie called Twilight, which was a detective story.
Oh, not the one with the vampires?
Not the vampire one. No, forget the vampires. But we were working on this.
I didn't see that.
We were working on this on the screenplay for that, and we worked on it for several months, and we had about half of it written. And Benton sounded worried one day and says, "Can you come to New York? I think we really need to talk about this." So I said, "Fine," and I went to New York. And we sat down with the first 60 pages of the screenplay, this murder mystery, and Benton looked at me and said, "All right, who did it?" And I said, "I was hoping you knew." and so we basically we did. All right, we sat down, we made a decision. Who's the murderer? There were four major characters in it. We said, "Who's the murderer?" We decided on it, and then we went back to all the things that we had done in the first half of the script that would not be consistent with what we just decided, right? And it was kind of the same way with this book. Once I figured out what actually happened to Jacy, then you have to go back and take out everything that's going to
screw that up.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
So let us talk about the three 66-year-old men. Mm-hmm. There is Lincoln. Tell us about Lincoln.
Lincoln is the most conservative, both politically and culturally, and perhaps most importantly, emotionally. He's the one registered Republican in the group. But more importantly than that, he's become a cautious man. In that sense, he represents pretty much every time in my own life when I wanted to take a risk and just felt like I couldn't. Because if I failed, I wouldn't just be failing myself, I would be failing my wife, my children. We won't go through them all, no reason to do that, but we all have those times in our life, right, when we feel like being brave, being bold, taking a risk is something you desperately want to do until you begin to think of the possible consequences, not just on yourself, but on other people. And those kinds of, if you do that often enough, that's who you become. You become a risk-averse person. Someone who's, this has become a habit, and at age 66, after four decades of that, it's a habit that's very difficult to break.
And then we have Mickey.
Mickey also derives from my own life in certain ways. He's a character, that central characteristic of Mickey's is that he is simply a rock and roller. I just turned 70. I have been pretty happy with the career that I've chosen. Most days, I look at my life, which has been blessed in so many ways, and I think to myself, all right, I've lived the right life. Writing these books was what I was meant to do until the right song comes on the radio. And I think of the various guitars that I have had in my life, and really, all I want to do is strap one on, plug it into a killer amp, turn up the volume to something deafening. And at that moment, I know that I've lived the wrong life. When that song comes on the radio. And Mickey of the three has perhaps been the most true to his conviction about playing rock and roll, has really never wavered. So he's the one who has the fewest kind of career regrets.
And then there's Teddy.
And Teddy, who also represents another characteristic of mine. You know, it's funny, we always think of ourselves as one person, don't we? You know, but we are, I think Whitman was right. We contain multitudes, all of us. Teddy derives from that part of my life, probably my early life, where the spiritual dimension of living was really kind of up front in my own life. Those of you who have been reading my books for a while probably will not be stunned to learn that I was an altar boy right straight through high school. And I was, like Teddy in this book, right up through high school, unable to decide, even when I was an altar boy, even when I was kneeling, even when I was celebrating the Mass with Father whoever, even when I was lighting candles on the altar, my mind would drift to the various high school girls with whom I was either in love or falling in love with, and thinking I would have to classify them as impure thoughts. Even as I was kneeling at the consecration of the Mass, my mind was drifting in those ways.
You have to confess something.
Well, yeah, and thoughts are somewhat easier than deeds. I'll agree with that. But I was able to balance in my own mind. It didn't even strike me as paradoxical that I would be having those thoughts. Even as I thought, there was also the possibility that I would end up a very holy man. And Teddy, Teddy's able to balance those contradictions. He is a small press publisher who publishes works of spiritual dimension, and he's called it seven-story books. That's the paradox he's had to live his life out trying to reconcile.
So this is how you describe him in the novel. His Adam's apple looked like it had been borrowed from another, much larger man, and his clothes never seemed to fit. When his shirt sleeves were the right length, there was enough room in the collar for a second neck. If the collar was snug, his cuffs ended midway between elbow and wrist. His waist was 28 inches, his inseam 34, so pants had to be ordered special. In the middle of his forehead, there grew a luxuriant tuft of coarse hair that was surrounded by a wide moat of pale, mottled skin. That just seems, when I think of a Richard Russo character in many of your novels, I would think of someone like that.
You know, most of us are kind of odd-looking, really, aren't we?
Oh, God, yes. That's why I'm on the radio, Rick.
Yeah.
But you seem to enjoy in describing the character.
If there's a single conviction which has driven my books, is that most of us, if we are not fools, we are capable of great foolishness. And it's the tie that binds us all together. And so, to a certain extent, to describe a character like the one that you just read about there, is to me kind of making the outside fit the inside, in a way. Because we're all kind of weird inside, too. We all, even those, you know, if you think of yourself as a fairly intelligent person, you know, and maybe you are day to day, but we're also capable of the most outrageous idiocy. And that's where the fun is. And so, yeah, watching, it's not a mistake that the word fool is in two of the titles of my novel. And I don't have to go out into the world looking for foolishness. I mean, I just look in the mirror or direct my eyes inward to feel that sense of kinship. To describe a character the way I did that one, to me, it's kind of fun because you see how the body that he presents to the world explains so much of what's going on inside of him. Because he has to live like that, right, just as we all do.
Richard Russo is our guest. The name of the new novel is Chances Are. You dedicate the book for those whose name are on the wall. in that prologue that you mentioned, in which we learn so much about the book, we also learn that these are three men who are waiting for their fate when it comes to the draft.
And that really is the genesis of this novel, that particular moment in time. And one of the things that I might have predicted about this book, although I didn't, was that when I would do events, people would come up later in the signing line. What I didn't realize was how many of them would want to tell me what their number was. It's been one of the most gratifying aspects of touring with this book, is to see it land that way with so many people of my own generation. And also, not just guys. The men come up and they want to tell me about their number and how it impacted their lives, whether they were spared the draft because of it or whether that they knew that within a matter of months they would be heading off to Southeast Asia to fight a war that nobody had really bothered to explain to the American people in any coherent way, or whether you were stuck in the middle somewhere like Lincoln is with a number that I chose his number 189 because 188 was the last number for which men that year, young men that year, were actually called up to serve in the draft. This book has its origins for me at the University of Arizona, where I was slinging hash at a sorority house and remembering the way all of us hashers came into the room that night. We were all friends, you know, and we'd always thought of ourselves as, because we were there at the same institution and, you know, we always felt that we were friends, but that we were also kind of in the same boat. We all learned that night that we had very singular destinies. And I remember I was blessed. I gave Teddy my draft number in this novel. Teddy's draft number, 322, which makes him safe, was mine. But I remember leaving that room, one of the last, leaving that room, walking across the large University of Arizona campus to tell my then girlfriend, now my wife of 48 years, what my number was. The Vietnam War haunts this novel, and for guys my age, whether you were somebody who served or somebody who lucked out like I did, even if your thoughts and convictions about that war haven't changed an iota, what has changed for us is the sense that if we were lucky, we find ourselves thinking at this point in our lives, and you go to visit the wall and you see all those names on that wall, and you do think to yourself, did one of these names represent a young man who died in my place?
There is a line, it comes relatively early in the novel, where Lincoln is trying to remember something and said, had Lincoln even spoken to his mother that evening? Here again, memory, like a conscientious objector, refused to serve. That's really good.
Yeah, thank you. I felt the same way when I stumbled on that. I was looking for a metaphor there, and suddenly there it was. You know, most writers aren't smart enough to think of those things in advance, but boy, they sneak up on you sometimes. And you just have to be smart enough to recognize it. You can't plan those things down to that. But you know, I won't lie to you. I felt the same way when that sentence came out, and I was able to use that conscientious objector metaphor in that particular line in the novel. I felt both proud of myself. I thought, this is good. But I also thought, you know, this is the way writers very often feel about the best aspects of their work, is that, you know, this line is just so much better than I am. Where did this come from? There's certain things you just think these are just gifts. You don't know where they come from. You're just so grateful to receive them. Those are prideful moments. It's strange because they're moments of pride, but they're also very humbling moments too, because you can't, if you can do that, you'd like to be able to do it all the time with every sentence.
Right.
And of course they're just the rarest of gifts.
We mentioned Teddy, who is this is a publisher of the small press, mm-hmm. a religious press, and you write he's basically found this, what he can do, what he's good at is fixing,
right?
Fixing editing.
Yeah.
And you write, here was the problem: the book might be fixable, but Teddy doubted Everett, one of the professors at the college that had written, was, Teddy doubted Everett was the man for the job. There were technical flaws, lots of them, and those could be addressed easily enough. But what was really wrong was deeply rooted in his colleagues' education and experiences. The classes he'd taken and avoided, his natural aptitudes, his blind spots. In a word, his character. Teddy felt this was far more often the case than writers realized.
Yeah.
Tell me about your character.
I was thinking about my own character and sometimes lack thereof when I was writing that passage, of course. And when I first started writing stories and novels, I was living at the time because I was doing graduate work at the University of Arizona, which was, of course, a long way from home, which most of you know is not that far from where we sit today. So I was a long way from home. I wanted more than anything else to be a different kind of writer than you might expect if you knew me. I would have loved to have written urban novels because I thought that was where a lot of the real excitement was coming from. Mm-hmm. I loved crime novels. I would have loved to have written crime novels. I would have loved to have written about dames in the way Raymond Chandler did. The problem was that I didn't know anything really about cities. I didn't know anything about crime, and I really knew nothing about women. But that was the kind of writer that I wanted to be, the kind of writer that I was so ill-equipped to be. And what I wanted, this was the state of my character at the time, was who I was something that I really wanted to conceal from everybody. And it took me a very long time to recognize who I was and what I was put here to do. We've been talking about this particular book as a Vietnam novel, which it is. It doesn't take place in Vietnam. Vietnam haunts the novel. But if you look at the rest of my work, the kind of totality of my work, not much of it has been about my own generation. It's been about my parents' generation. And I think it took me a while to understand that that small postage stamp of fictional reality that was just that little area from kind of Gloversville to Saratoga, let's say, that very small postage stamp area of land. But even smaller than that, the neighborhood that I grew up in Gloversville, New York, my father and mother's generation, that was that first generation of immigrants, first wave of immigrants, Irish, Italians, Poles, Slavs. Those men who came home from World War II, who had the idea that having won that war was going to change America, they were this incredibly hopeful generation, and the women were the same way. They felt that having won that war, Americans of all stripes standing together, of course they did not count black people in this, it has to be said, but they felt the American dream was alive and well for them. And most of the promises had not yet been broken. And it took me a while to realize that my job as a storyteller was just not to forget those people. That these were the people that I loved the most, worried about the most, cared the most about. And that like Faulkner, who had his little patch, his little dirt patch in Mississippi that he got all of those novels out of, that he somehow learned at some point that that's who he was. And he learned who his people were and which of their stories was important. And I look back on it now and I wonder what took me so long. Why did it take me so long to know who and what I loved? But there again, as that passage that you just read, that when writers fail, it's often not because they lack talent. It's not a matter of skill, usually. It's simply a matter of self-knowledge. Until you figure out who you are and what you love, your writing simply, it may be proficient. You may be able to publish. It won't stand in the way of your success, necessarily. You're just never going to be very good.
Later on, you write, over time, Teddy came to suspect that what he lacked was an obsession. Had he been a horse, his trainer would have put blinders on him, narrowed his field vision. Intellectual curiosity, moreover, was not the same as talent, and he gradually came to understand that his own particular aptitude was for fixing things. From an early age, he'd possessed an intuitive grasp of how and why things went off the rails, as well as how to get them back on again. So then was a point where you found your obsession then?
Yeah, I remember it very clearly. I was finishing up my PhD in literature, getting ready to become a college professor. I remember telling my wife, I don't think I want to do this. And I still remember the look on her face. It was terrifying. It was a terrifying look, having spent all this time and money. But I walked across the hall from the English department to the creative writing department and walked into a very kind man. I said, I have this terrible feeling that I might want to be a writer. And he said, well, let me see a story. And I said, well, I haven't written one. And he said, well, maybe you should. That would be the first thing to do. And I wrote one, and he put me in a class, and in my first, almost had finished a PhD, he put me in an undergraduate writing class. That's how much I had to learn. And I remember just had that feeling of having been bitten by some sort of a bug, and I just couldn't get it out of my system. This sense of must, I must do this. Once that obsession hits and you recognize it for what it is, it will take over, sometimes more than is entirely healthy. But I do remember what it felt like.
So let us end here, which is Teddy has a professor, Tom Ford, who is really the mentor, the one who kind of gets him on the road, the one who stays with him for a long time in his head, too.
Yeah.
You write, what you can't afford to lose is precisely what the world robs you of. How it knew what you needed the most, just so it could deny you that very thing, was a question for philosophers. Answer it, and you'd have the kind of book Tom Ford would have considered worth writing. Urgent and new and absolutely necessary. To write it, though, you'd have to be on fire. You still feel the fire?
Absolutely. People who know me and know me well know that I'm as full of shit as ever. I've expelled a lot of it. But it just keeps building up all over again. And I felt sad a number of years ago when the great Philip Roth said that he was done. He didn't want to write books anymore. He said he felt like he'd been carrying a piano all these years. He just wanted to set the piano down. I felt very bad actually to hear him say that, because the body of his work was so staggering. And I'm willing at some point, because reality is reality and you have to face up to it, there may come a time when my work diminishes in terms of power. There may be a time in which I'm no longer capable of my A game, because what's going on inside our heads is not completely unlike what goes on inside our bodies. And as we age, we find we're not always capable of doing some of the things we did effortlessly when we are younger. And so I am perfectly willing to accept the fact that at some point I will simply no longer have that A game as a writer. But what I cannot accept is the day will ever arrive when I wake up in the morning and I don't want to do it.
Richard Russo's new novel is Chances Are. It is published by Knopf. It is always a great pleasure, Rick. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you. Thank you all.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded at the Zenkel Music Center on the campus of Skidmore College in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Saratoga Springs, New York, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.